And while Sue is telling us, Jack Evans, come on up. Greg, Tom Gallagher. Greg, sorry, can't make out the last name. Three of you, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2272 adds compliance with low emission standards as requirement for registration of motor vehicles beginning with model year 2009. It directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to promulgate rules defining what constitutes compliance with low emission motor vehicle standards and identifying new motor vehicles exempt from the requirement. Requires rules to be consistent with relevant Environmental Quality Commission standards and defines new motor vehicle.
Thank you, Sue. Jack, welcome.
Thank you. Chair Vakian, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation, here to speak in support of ODOT's bill, House Bill 2272, which would grant DMV the authority to enforce compliance with auto emission standards through the denial of registration for vehicles that for model years 2009 or later do not meet the new tougher Environmental Quality Commission standards. In 2006, these standards were adopted in Oregon, and Oregon joins Washington and California in adopting these tougher emission standards. What the issue here is that there are dealers in other states, bordering states such as Idaho, that do not have to comply with these particular standards. What this bill would do would grant DMV the authority to deny registration for vehicles of 2009 or later years, or 2009 model vehicles with 7,500 miles or less registration if they don't meet these standards, and in this way would level the playing field for dealers in Oregon who might be at a competitive disadvantage by out-of-state dealers that could sell vehicles conceivably at a lower price because they didn't have to have the equipment to meet these standards. What DMV would do would be by rule determine what the what would constitute proof of compliance. They would deny registration starting in 2009 for vehicles that were not in compliance and establish rules that outline some exceptions, and these will be consistent with the rules that have been adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission. So with that, I'll entertain any questions you might have.
Committee, why don't we do questions of the agency here before we move on? Do you have any? All right, Mr. Gallagher.
Go ahead. My name is Greg Remisberger. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and I'll keep this fairly short. When the California emissions rules were adopted, at the time that we talked to the governor about his line item veto of the DEQ budget, this was one of our concerns, is the economic impact that will affect our dealers if this rule is not implemented. And he didn't have the authority at the time he was doing his line item veto to put it in. So we have requested that he look at this and push it through. We're in support of the bill. The states on the East Coast that have implemented the California emissions and not included this rule have seen an economic impact, because the consumer that wants to buy this vehicle that doesn't meet California emissions will buy it, and they'll bring it back in and register it in there. So it's taking dollars out of a revenue stream that's typically an Oregon revenue stream and bringing it into, as he mentioned, Idaho. So.
Very good. Anything to add? All right. Thank you three very much. Lindsay Capps, Daryl Fuller, Jeremiah Bauman.
Chair Vakian and members of the committee, Lindsay Capps with the Oregon Environmental Council, coming here today to express our strong support for HB 2272. We think this is an important piece in implementing the Oregon Clean Car Standards, which will cut global warming pollution from new cars and trucks by an average of 22% by 2012 and by an average of 30% by 2016. So we think this is a good program. This is obviously an important piece of legislation in terms of ensuring the integrity of that program, in requiring compliance with the Clean Car Standards, and we urge the committee's support for the bill.
Good. Mr. Bauman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeremiah Bauman with Osberg. Osberg also endorses this bill wholeheartedly. I would like to also just note for the record that because the regulations put in place by the Environmental Quality Commission affect not only traditional air pollutants but also global warming pollution, that means a lot of the compliance that the manufacturers will use will be in the form of measures that also increase gas mileage standards. So while there's an increase in the upfront cost of a car, it's more than made up for by the increased fuel economy of those cars. In fact, the automakers study done to argue against this program a couple of years ago, now that gas is at $3 a gallon, their math also shows a financial benefit for Oregonians due to this program. So we think it'll be a win-win for everybody involved, but also certainly want to make sure that Oregon auto dealers aren't going to have to face any competition from across state lines because of that increasing the upfront cost of a car.
Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. As has been indicated before, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted rules that placed the California Air Resources Board standards on Oregon vehicles starting with the 2009 model year. DEQ doesn't have the authority to do registration denial. That's Department of Transportation, which is why this bill is here. There are penalties in the environmental quality rules for dealers selling vehicles that don't comply, but purchasers do not currently have any penalties for purchasing a vehicle that does not comply. This simply makes this closes that loop and ensures that Oregon residents buy vehicles that comply. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Let me get this straight. You're maintaining that these cars are going to save consumers money, but that consumers are going to flood out of state to buy cars that are better and cheaper.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there are two components of the cost equation related to this program. The upfront cost of the car, which does increase depending on which study you look at. The low end is various state agencies saying, I think, on the order of $1,000, if I'm remembering right, and then the automakers saying it's about a $3,000 increase in the upfront price of a car. The savings on the gas mileage that result from the standards reduce the gas mileage sufficiently that under the state agency estimates, it always saves money. Under the automaker estimates, it saves money as long as gas is at $3 per gallon or higher, because they estimate a savings of about 1,000 gallons over the first 5 years of the car's ownership. There are two situations in which you could see the disincentive happen. One is if somebody doesn't finance their car, so they're paying the full upfront cost, they're going to pay the full upfront cost increase, and then they'll have to wait to earn back those savings in gas savings. In Oregon, though, my understanding is that somewhere upwards of 90% of Oregonians do finance their cars. Even in that case, you'd actually get the you get the savings in the first month because your car payment goes up, but your gas goes down by even a larger amount. Because the primary thing a consumer's looking at is the cost of the car up front, I think you could see people, just because they see the lower price, that might go across the state borders. We maintained during the procedure on this rulemaking that I actually don't think a lot of people would cross state borders to get a car that had better gas mileage, just because it's a little less expensive up front. But that doesn't mean we don't want to make sure that the enforcement of the program is perfectly fair for Oregon auto dealers vis-a-vis out-of-state auto dealers.
Well, Mr. Chair, follow-up. These arguments were made prior to this, and in the last legislative session, that cars were going to cost more. Your groups, not you, Darrell, your groups still push for these standards, and now you're saying that consumers aren't smart enough to figure out what's going to cost them more or what's going to cost them less. And I would argue that there are hybrid cars being sold, and those cost more than standard cars, and yet consumers seem to buy those even though they cost more. So your argument is, even though we told you this was going to be the case, now you're coming back and saying, well, we didn't, consumers aren't smart enough to figure it out, so we got to try to protect and bail ourselves out, and the governor, quite frankly, for doing this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it's certainly not our position that consumers aren't smart enough to figure it out. I think they are smart enough to figure it out.
If they were smart enough to figure it out, they wouldn't go to Idaho and buy cheaper cars and it cost them more money.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, and that's exactly why my position has been that we don't think people are going to flood across borders.
But then you don't think
we
need this bill.
But we do think that the provisions ought to be enforced equally, regardless of where somebody buys a car.
All done?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'd run now. Except, Mr. Fuller, you could walk slowly. I think you're all right. Okay. All right. Close the public hearing on 2272 and open a work session on 2272. If I could have a motion, I don't believe we have any amendments. No.
Mr. Chair, would you accept a motion for House Bill 2272 to pass with a due pass recommendation to the floor?
Yes, thank you, Senator Bates. Moving 2272 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll be voting yes today, but that may be subject to change.
Okay. Thank you. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Bates, why don't you carry this one, if that's all right?
I'll be glad to.
And with that, I'll
sure
close.
I want to ask Senator Bates the same questions.
But I'm going to check the tape. All I know is I'm going to Kellogg, Idaho this weekend and buy me a car.
I guess he heard enough, didn't he? Close the work session.
But don't tell Mr. DeBoer, okay?
Close the work session on 2272, and let's see, is Mr. Elliker back yet? No, let's... Yes?
74?
Yeah, it's okay. We'll wait. Yeah, we'll wait just a minute till he gets back. We'll go to House Bill 2974, open a public hearing on that one. Sue?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2974 creates exemptions to scenic highway requirements under the Forest Practices Act for harvest within an urban growth boundary and for harvest within zones designated for rural residential development pursuant to an exception adopted to the statewide land use planning goals.
And Ray Wilkerson and Ted Lorenzen, if you could come on up.
Chair Ibaki, members of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. Currently, the Department of Forest does have authority to waive retention of roadside trees in these areas, but in a practical sense, this will create an efficiency because in these types of zones, we almost always waive the requirement due to the conflict with infrastructure, and getting that efficiency will improve our ability to administer the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Also creates improved consistency amongst the various urban growth boundaries where some cities like Salem have adopted ordinances that waive our regulation of forest practices. They don't have scenic requirements, so it'll be that consistency as well created out of this. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Wilkerson, why don't you go ahead first?
Okay, very briefly, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I'm just here to let the committee know that we support this bill for the reasons that Mr. Lawrenson articulated.
Thank you. Committee, any questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Just curious, I mean, how many or how often do you have harvests in, of greater than 5 acres inside of the urban growth boundaries in these scenic corridors?
Senator Bakken, or Chair Bakken, Senator Beyer, not that common, but is not unusual. For example, the city of Sandy has some fairly large parcels within their urban growth boundary. They do not regulate forest practices, and we've been drawn into a number of not-in-my-backyard issues over those kind of harvests that people use the scenic buffer opportunity to try and thwart the development within those kind of parcels that are already zoned for development. So it's not common, but it's something that's often very time-consuming.
All right. Thank you both very much. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 2974, open a work session on 2974. For a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2974 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Pozanski. Move 2974 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Senator Beyer, if you would. Close the work session on 2974. Open a work session on House Bill 3291. Actually, we don't have anybody signed. Christine McNitt, come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3291 removes water control districts from the list of districts automatically extinguished when the entire area of a district is incorporated or annexed by a city.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I wasn't in here in time to sign up. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, representing the Oregon Water Resources Congress, which I don't think I've been in front of you wearing that hat before. We're a trade association of irrigation districts, water control districts, and other type of districts that deliver non-potable water. So if you can't drink it, we're probably delivering it. Included in some of those districts that we represent, water control districts, they're very similar actually to irrigation districts, and they do provide irrigation districts, but also often provide other services such as drainage and flood control and surface water control. And they're operated under a separate statute, chapter ORS 553. House Bill 3291 was drafted at our request to remove the water control districts from a list of specific special districts that are automatically extinguished when the service areas of those special districts become incorporated or annexed into a city. Typically, when special district territories are annexed or incorporated, the annexing entity already provides those services, such as fire protection. In the case of water control districts, the canals, ditches, and other associated waterworks are not already provided for by the annexing entity, and the need for the district continues. In some cases, like flood control, it's almost taken for granted about the service. The bill would make it clear that these services provided by the water control districts would continue to be provided and that the water control district would not be automatically extinguished.
Ready?
Just a quick question to make sure I understand this. In my area, as an example, Medford years ago annexed some property out in an area where the Talent Irrigation District brings water in. There's subdivisions there, but there's also some scattered. There's some nice little farms. They maintain their water rights, and ditches still run to them, even though there might be homes around them. Was the TID actually extinguished when that was annexed, potentially?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that's kind of interesting. You bring up Talent TID, and that's actually an irrigation district. And irrigation districts long ago pulled themselves out of these statutes for automatic extinguishment. And I had Larry Trosi, the general manager of the Saniam Water Control District, testify on the House side. He said, well, water control districts must have been asleep at the wheel when that legislation passed because they weren't included. So I guess to answer your question, irrigation districts have been extinguished from this list, so they do continue to exist. Urbanization, though, is always a challenge for districts, whether you're a water control district or an irrigation district, but they continue. Water control districts, however, under current law, would be automatically extinguished as urbanization creeps into their territory. So they just want to get out of that list and have the opportunity to continue to serve. And remember, in these districts, what's kind of interesting is a lot of times the point of diversion for the water right is miles away from the place of use. And so there's an intricate system of canals and delivery systems that run through an area as it's being urbanized. And so it's important to keep that whole and not have chunks of it kind of disappear.
Follow up just to make sure I understand this, if I could. Another example, in Eagle Point recently, we put a subdivision in. And their ability to control flooding there was lost the first couple of years. The ditches that had been there to control flooding through that area were actually, we didn't know who controlled them anymore. And the first winter there, they had a lot of homes flooded and backyards flooded. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Mm. Mr. Chair, I would imagine so. I'm not familiar with those details, but those are the types of services that water control districts provide.
That makes sense.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McNitt. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3291 and open the work session on 3291.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3291 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Prozanski moves 3291 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion or objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Prozanski, if you would.
All right.
And with that, I'll close the work session on 3291 and open a public hearing on 2565. Mike Graney, Sean Miller, Jeremiah Bauman, why don't you come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2565 establishes minimum energy efficiency standards for certain products. It allows the director of the State Department of Energy to adopt rules in certain cases to modify minimum energy efficiency standards and the operative dates of minimum energy efficiency standards. It directs the governor to cause to be introduced to the Legislative Assembly a bill to conform statutory minimum efficiency standards and operative dates with department rules. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Mr. Graney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Mike Graney from Department of Energy. And this bill is a technical fix for legislation passed last session. It was House Bill 3363 that set energy efficiency standards for 11 different appliances and electrical equipment. The standards were based on California standards so that we would have a set of consistent energy efficient standards in a number of states. Subsequent to our passage of the legislation, California made changes on the effective date and, in one case, a substantive change in two of the appliances. One is the certain chargers for equipment. The other is one of the lights, one of the light bulbs. This bill makes those changes, makes the same changes, makes them consistent. It also gives the department limited rulemaking authority, so if this happens again, we'd be able to make the change by rule and then come back to the next legislative session for ratification. But we'd be able to make the change effective immediately so that the manufacturers aren't in a situation where they've got conflicting standards between states, because that's not what we're attempting to do.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the National Electrical Manufacturers Association and the lighting division in that association, which includes companies such as Philips, General Electric, and Sylvania, which are the manufacturers of most of the light bulbs in the United States. And looking at the energy efficiency standards last session, 3363, there was this inadvertent mistake, if you will, on one light bulb, and that's this incandescent reflector bulb. And when you create an inconsistency among the western states when distribution of those light bulbs into those states that are sold in every grocery store, Home Depot, one of the things that was in Oregon was there was essentially a ban on all these particular light bulbs. And I think the intent was, and what it eventually was adopted in California and Washington, was to take these bulbs, which you can buy in 100 watt bulbs, and from an energy efficiency standard not be able to sell them in Oregon. This is a 65 watt bulb. It's in my home, it's in most homes, it's all throughout my home, and actually if we do not pass this bill, I would not have been able to buy this light bulb for my home in Oregon. And so this particular bill fixes that problem. Again, California adopted those regulations. Washington, and one of the problems that we had, and we worked with the department very closely in the interim, because with our these set in statute, when you have an inconsistency like this, again, it creates a big problem for these companies. And Washington, unfortunately, has sessions every year. So they had the same problem. They had a year ahead of us to fix the problem, and they did pass it in their last session. So we're back, and obviously want to be able to buy this light bulb for my house. It's particularly on page 11. It gives you the criteria of the exemptions of these reflector bulbs. Again, it's by wattage, and so this would be inclusive and be able to be sold in Oregon again. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Mr. Bauman?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeremiah Bauman with Osberg is one of the advocates for HB 3363 last session and setting an energy efficiency standard for these products. I just wanted to voice our support for making sure we keep these up to date technically so we have consistent energy efficiency standards for all the states that are leading the way on this particular issue.
Good. Ms. Earls?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing the Consumer Electronics Association. Consumer Electronics Association represents manufacturers of more than 2,100 high-tech companies, including several in Oregon. We are the manufacturers of the other product that was sort of left out when the change happened in California, which is the AC/DC adapters and power strips and things like that. So we ran into the same problem as Mr. Miller's association with a different type of product, and this technical fix would enable us to sell these products in Oregon legally. We would appreciate it. Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Let me get this straight. We followed California blindly again, kind of like auto emissions, and it was such a good deal. Now we've got to come back, pass a new bill, and in this bill, we're going to give the Department of Energy the ability to override what the legislature does because the legislature can't get it right.
The question?
More of a comment.
I thought so. Thank you very much, well, the four of you. Senator Bates.
Can I offer a comment, too? Well, first off, when I get that truck in Kellogg, I'm filling up full of these bulbs and bringing it back. I can clearly see we got a market here we got to take care of. You know, what it really cries out for in both these issues, really, is that we need federal legislation. It's really unfair to manufacturers to have states at different levels. One of the things we were facing before, I remember from last session on this, was that Oregon was sort of becoming a bit of a dumping ground for less energy efficient electrical appliances, because that's where the market went. But it would be much better if we had a federal legislation that said, okay, we're going to level the playing field across the country. You guys wouldn't have to go through this. We wouldn't play a catch-up or leapfrog with the states around us. This is not the best of ways to go about it, but it's a way of leading us towards a better future, we hope, as far as energy is concerned. But I think Senator Byrd has a point. I'm going to support the bill because I want this changed, and I want us to move forward as far as energy efficiency is concerned. But is it the best way to go? No, it's not. Is there a better way to go? Yeah, but that takes some federal leadership. So we can't do much about that. We can whine and complain, but we'll do the best we can now to get you guys off the hook. And I'm leaving it for Idaho. So,
Mr. Chair, yeah. I guess I'm not going to support the bill, and I would contradict that the best way to solve this is not state legislation or federal legislation, but a thing called the market, and the market works.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I'll go ahead and support the bill. I want to make sure Mr. Miller's not in the dark. So,
you got this oath for your house?
Okay, you guys run, too. Public hearing is closed. Now, I would agree with you, too. We'd so often follow other states and do it quickly and not as carefully as we should. We got to be more careful with that. Work session on House Bill 2565.
Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move 2565 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Moving 2565 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion?
One no vote.
Objections? Senator Beyer noted. With that so ordered, and I will carry that one. Close the work session 2565. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2545. Ron Anglin and Al Elkins.
2445.
Well, that's 2445 is what I meant to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2445 amends the definition of charge related to use of public lands to specify that it does not include any amount received from a public body in return for granting permission for the public to enter or go upon the owner's land. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Welcome. Mr. Anglin, you want to get us started?
Thank you, Chair Vaughan, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Under current law, landowners who provide free public access to their property for recreational purposes are provided some level of liability shield. In recent times, the department has enacted several programs funded by the department to purchase access onto private property for public hunting. And this creates a gray, is falling within a gray area within the statute, whether by us purchasing as a state agency public access, if the landowner is still provided that liability shield. The changes in front of you, as presented by the Oregon Hunters Association, would clarify the statute to provide that liability protection under these public programs.
Very good. Mr.
Thank you.
Elkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Al Elkins, Oregon Hunters Association. We introduced this bill to help with clearing up that gray area, removing it, and ask you to support it. I've also passed out testimony from the Oregon Forest Industries Council, who also support the bill but could not be here today.
Very good. Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both very much. Close the public hearing.
Mr. Chair, excuse me. I'm sorry. I was sleeping. Just clarification, Ron. This is under this program, is the questionable liability only for lands that have been, that you guys have paid for access, or if it, is it also for habitat dollars?
Chair Vaughan, Senator Beyer, it is for the access when we are purchasing public access onto those lands through the A&H program, through the Upland Cooperative Access Program, Regulated Hunt Program. The habitat liability, typically there's not necessarily access associated with the habitat projects, and then it's up to the landowner on whether they wanted to allow the public on or not.
But I guess to clarify, if a landowner has or accepts habitat dollars and then has people come hunt on their property, are they subject to the same gray area by the acceptance of habitat dollars?
Chair Vaughan, Senator Beyer, the way the statute's written, or the way the amendment is written, it probably would cover them, but our interpretation would be that we are not paying them for access when we do habitat work on a landowner's land. Instead, we're paying them for something else to benefit wildlife, and then the access part would be tied in with what they wanted to do.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. Close the public hearing on 2445.
A good question.
Open a work session on 2445.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
Move House Bill 2445 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, who moves House Bill 2445 for a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I probably don't need to with the explanation we've just given, but will anyway declare a potential conflict of interest as I own property that has received the habitat dollars, and it may or may not be, but just to be on the safe side, to declare potential conflict of interest.
Noted. Any objections?
No, I got a question for Senator Byers real quickly. I know you want to get out of here. I'll ask him later.
No, that's all right. Go ahead.
If you put a can out in front of your property and everyone drops a buck in for coming on your property to hunt or fish, which is common in this state, and that money is usually used for maintaining a road or cleaning up after people go through it, which I see commonly done too. Though nobody makes any money off it, they just want to keep the place up. Does that open you up to liability because you accepted private money to it?
I don't think so, because that would be a donation. If you accept, yeah, I believe, and Mr. Anglin probably answered directly, I believe if you accept donations, it's not the same as charging an access fee.
Then that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Makes sense.
All right.
It is not being compliant.
Very good. Any objections? Okay. Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Beyer, are you okay giving your potential conflict carrying this one? I'd like you to, if you're comfortable.
Yeah.
All right. Fine. Senator Beyer will carry. Close the work session on 2445, and we are adjourned.